This is a previously recorded episode.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to yet another fun-filled edition of the M Squared TechCast. I believe it's our 23rd?
23.
Okay. Yeah, that means we're officially adults now, I guess, in internet news or something. Yeah.
I think I read somewhere where the adult brain doesn't really get completely formed until 23 or 24, so okay. Hopefully our brains are formed now.
Not so fully sure. Formed. I'm not sure fully what they're formed. Full of, but okay.
Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of talking to big brains, all that, I like that, Richard, looking at Richard
Steen. Nice
Steen
segue.
There. Yes, yes. Richard Steen, one of our cybersecurity experts, lives in Birmingham. How many up? 40,000 Twitter followers now? I saw some big number.
52,000.
Wow. Dang, wow. You're a media group within yourself. And on the phone calling in from the Lansing area is Dan Lorman, who formerly was the Chief Information Security Officer and other roles at the State of Michigan, and now with Security Mentor, where I always get your title wrong, so why don't you give me the correct title?
It's Chief Security Officer and Chief Strategist, but I don't have 50,000 followers like Richard does. So.
But they're good, high-quality followers.
Yes, absolutely. So what are we talking about today? Well, you know, cybersecurity is close to my heart. Richard and I did a cybersecurity thriller a few years ago, so he kind of learned me all this stuff and learned me. Yes, he did.
He learned me good.
Dang. And so I'm really plugged into it, but not as much as these guys are, who are going to talk about some really interesting news this week, where a federal judge is not asked, but ordered Apple to let him crack the iPhone. Whoa, and Apple CEO Cook has said, no, that's not going to happen. So obviously we've set something up here that's going to be interesting to follow. And then we're also going to be talking about Nitro Zeus. Wow, I just love that name. That's going to have to be for the next book, Richard. What do you think?
Oh, there we go. Put that right in
there.
Yeah,
Nitro Zeus. And that was apparently a plan that the U.S. government formulated before Stuxnet, that if Stuxnet didn't work, then they were going to unleash Nitro Zeus, which did all sorts of things, like attack the electricity grid and a whole sorts of other things along those lines. So I'll let you guys kick it off. What do you want to start, Apple?
Yeah, let's start with Apple. I'll go through the technical aspects here. So you remember the San Bernardino shooters, of course, and the law enforcement, you know, caught up with the shooters in their SUV and killed them, and then commandeered the guy's Apple phone. I think it was Apple phone 5. And they immediately, now here's the timeline of events, right? So they've got the phone of a perpetrator in law enforcement and intelligence. You always want to immediately know, like, who was that person talking to right before or during the shootings or during the chase that occurred afterwards. But they couldn't unlock it because the Syed Farouk was, you know, a good security guy, right? He kept the password on it. And Apple's got a feature that if you try and log in to somebody's phone over 10 times, it will essentially remove access to all the data on the phone. So it doesn't erase it. It's called a wipe, but it really just removes the keys so you can't decrypt it. So the FBI knows that. So foolishly, the FBI first contacted the county, and they said, hey, we want to get access to this guy's iCloud backup stuff. So the county says, well, okay, let's reset his password because they have the control in order to do that. They reset his password, and then they could see everything from the last backup, which was days before. In other words, they didn't get the most recent communications. So now they're stuck with – they've reset the password, so they can no longer get a backup. They can't get to the data in the cloud. So they go to Apple, and they say, you know, we'd really like to, you know, have you help us break into this phone. They've got a court order. They're asking Apple to create a special, you know, a new copy of the OS that they can plug in that allows them to attempt more than 10 tries without it wiping the disk or the memory in the phone. And Apple said, no, we're not going to do that. And the tech community seems to be 100% behind them. But the policy in law enforcement community is saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to use this for everybody's iPhone, just for this one particular iPhone. So, you know, on the moral stage, you go, well, of course, this is a terrorist. He killed a bunch of people. Apple should do whatever they can. On the other side, it's, yeah, but that kind of disvalidates all of Apple's security. So why don't you chime in, Dan, and give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, you did a great job summarizing it, Richard. I think, you know, just following this and posting different things in different, you know, LinkedIn and other websites out there, and you know, I think you nailed it. The security community, the technology community is backing Apple. It's clearly a good, marketing thing for them. I think there's been stories about, well, you know, maybe Apple made some compromises with China to sell devices over there. Isn't there some kind of way, you know, and you hear this from a lot of politicians and speeches over the weekend and different things, isn't there a way to cut a deal, somehow get them the data as this one-off and not make it a precedent-setting type of activity for Apple? And, I tell you, as former CSO for the state of Michigan and working a lot with Homeland Security and the FBI, it just seems like there's got to be some kind of compromise they're going to come up with that's going to get them the data, but maybe not make it so they have to give them the code or make it so that it sets a precedent for, you know, every person who's afraid that law enforcement's going to get into their iPhone.
Yeah, there certainly has to be a technical means to do it that, you know, maybe you would think the NSA and law enforcement in general, in particular the intelligence community, could write a whatever backdoor that Apple has been told to create. You'd think the NSA could do it probably with a little more alacrity. So which tends to say that, hey, the FBI is using this as a precedent-setting case rather than just going about their business and getting the data that they want.
Well, let me weigh in here. Is there some way that Apple could just download the data and give it to the feds without anything being violated? I don't know. Is there?
Evidently not, and if they did do that, that would send a real message to the market that your phones really aren't that safe.
Right? Yeah, good point.
So in other words, Apple has designed a phone that even Apple can't crack.
Yeah.
Or really cut,
absolutely.
Or doesn't want to know how to crack.
Yeah, if you read the documentation, the signing certificates for all the keys were actually destroyed by Apple, so even they don't have access to them anymore.
Hmm. Mm, boy, we really are in a dilemma here, aren't we? Hmm.
So, Richard, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, obviously this thing is going to ratchet up because they're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and I just can't believe that Apple's going to, at some point when somebody says we're going to dock your taxes or something, they're going to have to cave, right? I mean, do you think it really will? They'll really win out on this?
I think they can stick to their guns, right? They've probably got more money than the Justice Department has.
By far. They got like a couple hundreds of billions overseas.
Something like $700 billion. Yeah. This may be actually, it's just a way for the Justice Department to get them to repatriate all that money spend on attorneys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I just have to believe, I mean, maybe I'm, you know, Pollyannish here. I think there's going to be some kind of compromise that neither side is going to be totally happy with, but maybe that can't happen. I mean, I do support the principle Apple's backing, you know, which is, we can't have law enforcement, you know, just getting into our iPhones, you know, right and left, you know. At the same time, boy, oh boy, you know, terrorism is a pretty bad case.
Terrorism and most crime. I remember reading a quote from the head of the police department in New York City, and he said he basically said that every single crime in New York City is a cyber crime, and that they use, you know, cell phone access and data recovery as a way of prosecuting the criminals. And I think the demarcation that I certainly feel comfortable with is when the phone is physically present, right? It's if you've committed a crime and the law enforcement has your phone, the types of things you can do to it with the phone physically present, I don't think will jeopardize people's privacy and security with the phones that they have on themselves.
Well, I think that's the argument that law enforcement is making. It's like, look, we can look at your records. We can look at your documents. You know, we can even look at your computer. But this one thing we can't look at for some reason.
You know? Yeah, the car companies will tell us where you've been. And
yeah, the phone company will tell us who you've called. And you know, we have to get a warrant to do all this, so we can't do it to just anybody. And
well, in theory.
Well, yeah, we all know that if the government gets access to information, they'll never abuse it, right?
Of course. Hey, let me throw it out. You guys are the two experts here. Where is the compromise? If you were going to decide this, how this was going to work out so both law enforcement is served and the cyber community is served with privacy, how would you do that?
I'm not a very compromising person when it comes to privacy. But I think the demarcation should be at that physical ability to backdoor. So if you've got the phone present, it makes a huge difference, right? Because, you know, I know I've got my phone in my hand right now, and the NSA doesn't. So,
well, they do now. And
after I've been arrested and handcuffed and thrown in jail, I do not have access to my phone. Right. So, and if I had any secrets, I would encrypt them with something other than my cell phone provider's encryption keys.
So you vote for a back door that would only open up individual iPhones rather than go up to the cloud? Or how would that be done?
You'd have to be physically present.
Physically present.
Yeah, just like the difference between a credit card, being physically present. That's more security if you demand it.
And Dan, how would you do this?
No, I think I like Richard's idea. I think that's a really good suggestion. I mean, I can't argue with that approach. I mean, obviously, I think it didn't. I guess I would say two additional things. One, I do think there's probably going to be some new federal laws, legislation, whether we like it or not, in this area. I don't know, Richard, I know that's probably, maybe I think that's a good thing or bad thing. I don't know. I just have to believe that there's going to have to be some clarity, and clearly it needs to be, as we said earlier, with a court order. It can't just be done, their investigation or something. There has to be some kind of process that's put in place that goes before maybe there's some high threshold that's even above your normal judge, so that it's not, every crime that's committed or something. And I don't know.
We just have to be careful that a law doesn't require a manufacturer to make their devices less secure. Because that, one, it reduces competition and new entrants in the field. There are dozens of people trying to create secure cell phones right now. And we wouldn't want to overregulate an industry while we're just passing through this phase of, right now phones aren't all totally secure. But 10 years from now, they will. And law enforcement will have figured out other ways to get their jobs done.
Yep. No, I agree with that. I think that's a good solution.
All right. We got that solved, so let's contact that federal judge.
Well, we didn't talk about John McAfee, who volunteered. John McAfee, the original founder of McAfee, and sold it for a few million dollars back in the dinosaur ages of the internet.
Wish he could have kept it now, huh?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And he had to flee the country, et cetera. But now he is evidently the Libertarian Party candidate for president.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And you should watch his videos and stump speeches. They are actually brilliant.
Are they?
He just comes across so presidential in a Lincoln-esque sort of way.
Does he have a beard, too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not at all, huh?
And he's got a radio voice.
You got to have that.
Smoking too much something. But anyways, he's volunteered to use the.
No, that's the show later on IT and the D.
Well, and not only that, but yes, that is what they say about libertarians. It's conservatives that want to smoke pot. So.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Well, he's volunteered to crack that iPhone, even though he doesn't agree with the whole concept, but just to help Apple and help resolve the issue. And I'm sure there are plenty of that would. I think it's more important that we bring the issue to the forefront now. So get everybody talking about it like we are. I think it's great.
Hey, the other thing too now is I think anything's going to go legislative-wise this year until after the elections in November. And gosh, it's hard to say where that's going to go. I mean, you got some really right-wing candidates on one side and you got liberals on the other. And just think if we had an election with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, that's kind of an either-or choice there. But I don't know how that would affect what's going to happen in terms of, are they going to come out with new legislation then that will allow law enforcement to get into iPhones and things like that?
Well, Trump has called for a universal boycott of Apple. So we know where he thinks things should go.
That's going to work. Okay. Yeah. All right, well, moving on. Let's go on to...
He probably called for it on his iPhone, by the way.
He probably did, yeah. Yes. Maybe he's an Android user or something. But anyway, let's go on to Nitro Zeus. This is such a cool story.
That's the coolest name ever, I think.
Oh, God, love it, you know? But I'll let you guys explain it because it's...
Okay, and first to slightly correct what you said in your introductory comments.
Oh, I got it wrong then. Huh?
So evidently, first of all, this all came out because documentarians have produced a video.
I haven't seen it yet. Have you
seen it? Well, no, it was released at some film festival, so it hadn't been distributed yet. But it was a video of, you know, the background to the Stuxnet story, et cetera.
Got it.
During their interviews... They discovered that there was a much bigger story besides Stuxnet. So, as a reminder, Stuxnet was a project of the U.S. and Israeli intelligence community in order to infiltrate the nuclear refining capability in Iran, and succeeded in disabling, you know, up to 1,000 of their centrifuges. And up till now, that's been the most sophisticated cyber attack ever reported on. Well, evidently, leading up to and during all the negotiations with Iran to get them to back down from trying to get nuclear weapons that President Obama successfully completed, right? So now that's behind us, and the sanctions on Iran are coming off. But if that had not succeeded, you know, the other alternative was a military alternative. And according to Sanger in the New York Times, they planned a massive cyber attack on the infrastructure of Iran, in conjunction with a kinetic attack. In other words, they're going to use their bunker-busting bombs on Natanz and Fordow, where the two facilities are that they do this nuclear refining. So this is, you know, the first indication that a government has planned, you know, massive cyber attack in order to create the so-called digital Pearl Harbor that a lot of people in the military talk about, shut down all telecommunications, all power. And during that disruption, of course, a military attack. So in the hopes that the victim of the attack wouldn't be able to respond effectively, right? So it would be a much more effective attack. And that's kind of mind-boggling, right? It really... You
know, and this was developed 5 or 6 years ago, right?
Over the last 5 or 6 years,
yeah,
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Richard, what question I have, I mean, I've read different reports on this. Some said that they were going to use this if the nuclear talks had failed. Have you heard
correct.
Of that?
That's correct, yeah. If the nuclear talks had failed. But they didn't, so now they've, you know, all that has supposedly stood down.
I understand, but I mean, like, would it have been, I mean, in theory at least, or according to the documentary, if the nuclear talks had failed, they were going to do this as a preemptive strike before Iran could do something? I mean, just do it?
Yeah.
Or only if there was some kind of...
Send in the bombers, you know, huh?
Well, I'm sure it was an alternative, right? You know how the Pentagon works. They have to have, or they're asked by the executive branch, hopefully, to come up with alternatives, and this is the one that they had come up with. The amazing thing is that Sanger reports that there were thousands of intelligence and military personnel working on it, and they spent millions and millions of dollars preparing for it. And that's, you know, it's not quite like the cat's out of the bag, but it happens to fit exactly with most scenarios people have for incorporating cyber attack into future warfare.
Sort of mutual assured destruction on the cyber level.
No, it'd be pretty one-way, I think.
It is. Richard, I mean, if you think about it, is that there's also the same reports we're talking about that they placed all kinds of devices within the Iranian program, and so it makes you wonder, are they still there, and do other countries have them within our infrastructure? I mean, so it starts to raise all kinds of other questions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, and you know, I read a book about that, about a bunch of backdoors in American military equipment once. The author is sitting right here in front of me.
Yes, exactly.
I gave a plug to somebody else, so I don't know if it's a ring or not.
Okay. Oh, yeah. There we go. Okay, yeah.
Actually,
we'll
it's
that
a
there.
Revelation.
Cyber
somebody
stiletto.
Read that book.
Yeah, we sold a couple hundred of them, I think. You know, So
you know what struck me, Dan, is about, I don't know, 4 years ago, somebody approached me. He's a blogger in Israel, and he said he had a document that came from inside the Israeli government's staff committee meeting, and that they claimed that they had preparations for a massive cyber attack on Iran in order to disable everything before they sent in their jet planes and their bombers. At the time, I mean, that guy was vilified and shouted down. But you know, it's like it makes total sense. Any you know, reliable Pentagon would have that strategy in their toolkit.
Well, I'm sure Beijing and Moscow has something similar, right?
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
I'm sure everybody has gamed and developed stuff to use against everybody else. I mean, it's just a matter of how effective it would be, sure, based on how current it is. So,
in that kind of war scenario, let's take it one step further. If we begin to unleash all these cyber weapons that do all this damage to our, you know, telecommunications, computer networks, everything else, What's the end game there? What happens?
Well, the hope is that we'll see things like we saw in Ukraine around Christmas, where Russian hackers, probably supported by the government, induced a power failure inside a big region of Ukraine. And in the, I think we talked about it on the show, it was right when the airport was also shut down with the same malware, the Black Energy malware. To me, that's a good thing, right? It gives everybody is now on notice that your power grid is susceptible to this particular type of attack. So start looking for it and start defending yourself against it. If there were a attack similar to Nitro Zeus, you know, if one played out like that, it would be, I think it'd be very effective, first use kind of weapon methodology. It'd be asymmetric, right? The victim probably wouldn't be able to retaliate because it takes a lot of time to prepare that. But in the future, every potential victim in the world, which is every country that thinks that they could be attacked, will have to develop, one, ability to defend themselves, and two, their own ability to engage in those types of attacks, which means everybody has to defend themselves. And I'm all about defense. And there's no way, you know, if you defend yourself against a retaliatory attack from Iranian hackers and you keep the power grid more secure, then you're also defending yourself against the lone wolf hackers that could do this just as easily.
Yeah,
I think the other question,
Mike, is
to what extent, if everything, and we, you know, pretty much have said that on the show several times, it seems to be vulnerable as we roll out the Internet of Things, as we roll out, I mean, the wider question of cars and, you know, connected kitchens, and but also even pacemakers and health equipment. We just saw the big health breach last week with ransomware and the healthcare industry in L.A. To what extent, you know, does that just kind of move down the food chain and affect more and more devices in our lives?
Yeah, and we've relied on the attackers to show us which devices we have to worry about, as we just can't have the imagination to figure out, you know, what those potential attacks could be. And as there are more attacks, we learn more and we start spending more on fixing those problems.
Which is good for cybersecurity consultant types, right?
Yep.
Make a few more bucks, hey?
Awesome. You know, I'm an unabashed cheerleader for the industry.
There we go, yeah.
The Cybersecurity Full Employment Act of 2016.
As long as I have my escape plan off the grid on Beaver Island, I'm all set.
Yeah, there you go. That's. I don't think you can get cell service out there.
No,
can you?
No, you can't.
Perfect. Well, you know, as we move into the world of the Internet of Things, which is what Dan was talking about, where everything is connected, it is getting a little spooky out there, isn't it?
Spooky, yeah. It keeps me awake at night. How about you, Dan?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I certainly would never have expected, I shouldn't say never expected, but I continually be surprised as we move further and further down the road. You know, like, again, you know, ransomware that a hospital would pay, you know, to get their data back, like, you know, the story last week in L.A., it just really is, you know, I think it's a wake-up call. It was, you know, funny, my daughter, who, you know, is not into this at all, she's an elementary school, you know, teacher, major, doing student teaching now, and, you know, she told me about that story, and more and more people are becoming aware of the risks, and I think that's a good thing, but it seems like we have a new story every week.
Yeah, and every story also highlights the fact that places like a major hospital system in L.A. is totally oblivious to the need to defend themselves against this sort of thing. You know, it's The ransomware has been around forever, and only in the last 2 years has it become, I think, the number one priority for every CISO I talk to. It's just their nightmare. It's like, oh my gosh, the CEO comes to us and his laptop's been encrypted by these guys. Of course we're going to pay. They should be taking steps.
Do they pay in Bitcoin? Was it Bitcoin? Perfect.
Yeah, it was Bitcoin payment. Yeah.
No kidding.
I think 500
And the thing is, the question I would have, why didn't they have backups?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the scary part. I mean, it's like your records, you know, we got to pay this cyber thief $17,000, whatever the amount was, or we can't, you know, we can't do surgery tomorrow. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling.
Okay, everybody, Dan just said backup. That means tonight you have to back up your computers. Oh, every time you hear somebody say
that. I have two backups all the time.
Otherwise, the next day you go, oh, I wish I had listened to them.
But neither has a back door out there, so everybody's listening. So.
Well, that's what I've always been told is you know, buy a couple of those little terabyte backup things. Yeah. They've gotten real cheap.
Yeah, oh, God, yeah.
Back up your work computer, keep that one at home. Back up your home computer, keep that one at work. Both buildings aren't going to burn down or get broken into the same day. It's really easy. Super easy to do. So, you know, yeah.
Words of wisdom from two writers.
Well, we got about 2 minutes left.
Well, I don't want to lose all that writing.
That's right. Once a word is down on paper, never again do you want to rewrite
it. Yep. I got about 2 minutes left. So when are people going to wake up? Not people, but when are businesses going to wake up and really take this seriously?
Well, I've said this forever. I don't believe they will. I've given up on telling them to wake up. I believe each person and each business wakes up after they've been attacked.
So once the horse gets out of the barn, then they have religion.
And I just wonder if there's somebody at that hospital in L.A. was like, I've been bitching about this for years.
Was.
You know, I mean,
sure
we didn't have backups and we wouldn't. Yep. You know,
some CFO said, I'm not going to sign that check, right?
Yeah.
Guaranteed he had a ponytail.
Yeah. Well, Mike, there was a study, I think it was just released in the U.K., that talked about most CEOs were saying security is still getting in their way and stopping the business plan. So I still think that is a prevalent. I agree with Richard. It's on a case by case basis. Some people get it, and a lot still don't.
All right. Well, unfortunately, in this segment, we're gonna have to give these guys an hour at some point to go over all this really great stuff. I think because we just start getting into it and run out of time.
Yep.
And so we've had in studio, we've had Richard Steenen. Author of There Will Be Cyber War. How's that book doing, by the way? Is it selling?
No, it's doing great.
Okay, good. And Dan Lerman from Security Mentor, former CISO, CIO. I'm not sure if you're CIO at the state, but I know you've been involved in security for a long time.
CTO.
Yes. And if anybody's listening and wants to reach out to you guys, quick, give us a way to do that. What's your – how do you want them to contact? Email address?
Yeah, just you can start following me on Twitter at
– join those 52,000 other people.
At Cyberwar on Twitter.
Okay, and Dan?
Yeah, and I'm at GovCSO, so at GovCSO.
Okay, and I'm Mike Brennan.
And I'm Matt Rausch. And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast. We'll be back in just a minute with a segment on drone law. Going to be fun.
your turn.
Oh, after you. Okay, suddenly we've turned into those two little cartoon chipmunks. No, I insist. After you. It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast on PodcastDetroit.com.
Yes, we have to. I forgot. We should probably do the station break kind of thing and say where we're at. We're in the lovely. I'm looking out over here on Hilton Avenue in Ferndale, where it's a nice day. And we have on the phone from snowy Traverse City, right? You got snow up there, Enrico?
Still got a little?
We do. We still got a little left. A little rain last week, but apparently it's going to come back and snow again this week.
Yeah, we're supposed to get like 6 inches here on Thursday. I can't wait.
Seriously?
Yes, really.
Oh, boy. Well, anyway, we have. You can tell how much I like snow. That's why I don't live in Traverse City, but Enrico Schaefer does. He's our drone law expert at Drone Law Pro. How you doing today, Enrico?
Good. How are you guys today?
We're doing lovely. We also have in the studio with us Richard Steenan, our cybersecurity expert, who just did a segment.
Hey, Enrico.
Hey, morning.
Morning? Where are you at?
Good point.
It's afternoon
Hawaii,
here.
Hawaii, maybe.
Yeah,
it's morning
thinking.
In Hawaii.
He's on the left coast again. Okay. All right, so Enrico's going to be talking about, this is your area and not mine. I'm going to try to set this up. If I get it wrong, let me know. You're talking about Drone Law Part 107, which is supposed to go into effect sometime this year, where the House might exempt drones under 5.5 pounds. But that's as much as I know. Take it away, Enrico.
Yeah, so for you guys, you know this because we've talked before, but the FAA and the Congress have been trying to integrate drones into our national airspace. And, of course, how does the government do everything? It passes laws and regulations. So since really 2012, Congress had directed the FAA, and the FAA has been really active in trying to come up with regulations for commercial drones for all the commercial drone operators to follow in order to keep everyone safe. And, of course, the big issue out there is no one wants an incident between an unmanned drone and a manned aircraft, right? So the FAA did come up with some rules, what are known as Part 107. Part 107 rules could go into effect sometime this year. But before that is even scheduled to happen, Congress and the House of Representatives are jumping in here. And as part of their reauthorization bill for the FAA, they've come up with something called the micro drone rule. And the micro drone rule was offered by Rodney Davis of Illinois, House member. And it essentially exempts drones under 4.4 pounds from having to comply with all but a very few regulations. So it's essentially deregulating micro drones under 4.4 pounds before the regulations have even been put into play, which is always interesting when Congress is seeking to trump, to pardon the phrase,
it has a different meaning now. So actually, I got 5.5 pounds written down here. Was it 4.4 or 5.5?
It's 4.4 for the micro drone exemption, but there have been other attempts to regulate below 5.5. Of course, the manufacturers would like the number to be higher, right, and exempt as many drones as possible.
So this is your area. I haven't actually bought a drone yet. That's on my list to do. What is a typical drone that one uses weigh?
Well, it weighs under 4.4 pounds, which is why this bill chooses that weight class. So over 60% of all the drones in use in the United States right now are under that weight classification. And because the technology continues to evolve, many drones are getting lighter rather than heavier. So most of your DJI drones are under that 4.4 pounds. The 3DR Solo, a lot of this kind of really high-end consumer drone falls below that weight limit.
So that's the one that you spend a grand or so on?
That's actually the one I have. DJI Phantom 2.
Yeah, those are sort of semi-pro, right?
They're awesome. Kind of prosumer drones, right? They're somewhere between professional and consumer. There's a lot of technology packed into them, and they're almost all below 4.4 pounds.
Yep. Well, since we have a cybersecurity expert here, and that's always a hot topic, are drones hackable?
Oh, easily. Yeah, so the Parrot drones, which are kind of a hobbyist drone, are eminently hackable. They've got open source operating systems on them, and people hack them all the time. They get them to swarm together of course, take them over. My own drone, I was horrified to see, had no Wi-Fi access security on it whatsoever. So anybody else who has a DJI controller could take control of it from me. You know, so yes.
This is going to turn into a book, I can tell. I mean, this is just getting too good here. So, I mean, you could be out just flying your drone, and then somebody, you know, hijacks your drone and does bad things, but you take the fall because it's registered to you, right?
Or they could attack me with my own drone.
Which, right, you could use the same defense that you use when you arrive home from the bar at 2:30 a.m. That wasn't me. It was not me.
Yeah, well, they don't work either.
There's a very catchy song with that title, I think.
Okay. It ain't me, babe.
So Enrico, that I think the micro regulation you're talking about is the one that we had until sometime early February to register your drone. Though you're actually registering yourself as a drone operator.
Right.
And then supposedly you'll get your $15
registration
feedback. I did. I there's a lot of soul searching, right? Here's my time to channel my inner Thoreau and engagement in a little civil disobedience. But finally, I said,
the fines are all heavy.
The fines are extremely heavy,
you know. So,
and I completely agree that my drone, even in my hands, is extremely dangerous. Right? I'm right next to an airport.
You can't fly it within 5 miles, supposedly.
Right. So I won't be flying it in the park across the street anymore. You're supposed to stay under the 400 foot limit, 400 foot. And I could easily see somebody crashing into it in the air. I've seen near accidents on the ground when I gave the controls to somebody else. Mm. So, those things are really dangerous.
Well, then
it's great. It's a great point. I mean, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of pushback against the FAA for over-regulating this and going too slow. On the other hand, these things can cause harm, can cause injury, and it's a lot of technology to turn over to a novice. And right now you can go to the store, buy a drone, and launch it within an hour and have literally no training. So there is a need for safety. There's a need for some level of regulation. The big debate is how much is required to keep everyone safe.
Now, mind you, I can also go to the store and get a firework that shoots up to 1,000 feet in the air, and people do on the 4th of July, and we're right near an airport, and the airplanes are up viewing all the fireworks. So
hopefully not dodging.
I was going to say, you could also get model rockets that go up a couple thousand feet.
Yeah, Estes rockets.
Yeah, sure.
And kids launch those from our park, too, and there's an airport nearby. So
you could buy a gun in a lot of places and not have to register it.
And shoot it up in the air.
Or a laser, for that matter. Yes, laser blinding. Hey, you know, it brings up an idea I have. To be a pilot, you have to have a license. To be a drone pilot, should you have a license?
Well, it breaks down to two areas. Recreationally, you do not need a license. You just need to register, pay the $5, go to the FAA website, and get a number for yourself as an operator and put it on all your drones. As a commercial drone operator, right now you actually have to have a manned airline pilot certificate. It's called an airman certificate, and it's a sport or recreational level license, a hot air balloon license. There's several different ways you can get that airman certificate, but people are always shocked. They're like, you mean like a real airplane? And yeah, right now you need to have a real airplane pilot's license, and that's going to change with the new Part 107. If that gets implemented this year, then there'll be a SUAS, Small Unmanned Aerial System certificate you can get. But under this new House proposal, which right now is still early in the process, it's not a law yet, under that proposal, if you're flying a drone under 4.4 pounds, you won't need any sort of certificate in order to fly.
Is that a good
idea? To fly commercially.
Well, commercially or recreationally,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but okay. What I'm saying is it time for the FAA or Congress or whoever to rethink this and say to fly a drone, since there are hazards, you need to take some drone safety courses or something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and the answer is that something needs to be required in terms of accepting responsibility for your drone. In the FAA registration process, which was pretty controversial on the recreational side, the one good thing that it did do is it put the rules of the road in front of everyone who registered and said, you agree not to fly near an airport, fly near manned traffic, fly drunk, etc. And so, on the one hand, really educating people that drones can be dangerous and encouraging them to think safety first is really important. Regulating it and requiring people to go through training is probably overkill on the recreational side, especially for some of these small drones, which are really much more toys than they are anything else. So, and then there's the technology piece. A lot of the problems are being solved by technology. When drones can see each other in the air, when drones can sense and avoid, when you know drones have geofencing built in where they won't fly or take off near an airport, that helps solve some of the safety issues. And all of those things are happening right now. So I think personally on the commercial side, there should be a SUAS certificate. Insurance companies are ultimately going to require it anyway. But on the recreational side, there needs to be a little bit more tolerance for just making sure everyone gets educated on safety.
How much does all this safety stuff add to the price of a drone? This isn't going to be a freebie, right? I mean, to add all this technology, you're looking at hundreds of dollars per drone, right?
Well, you would think so, but they're being made in China by DJI and others.
Okay.
And so the price of poker goes down. It's for $1,000, you can get a high-end prosumer, professional consumer-level drone that's got so much technology baked into it, it's almost hard to believe. So a lot of the technologies coming out of the manufacturer side, they see the need for safe flight. They don't want an incident between manned and unmanned aircraft because it's going to drive their sales right into the ground and perhaps lead to even worse regulations. So everyone is working incredibly hard on drone safety.
My bad scenario is what's going to happen is a drone's going to get sucked into a jet engine somewhere. Shut that engine down. Maybe it won't crash the plane, but scare the hell out of everybody. I can say that because we're not on broadcast radio. And then Congress...
You could get worse if you wanted to,
thank you.
Okay.
And then Congress is going to step in and put the hammer down. Do you think that could be a scenario?
It definitely could be. It could become an election issue. It's probably more likely on a small single-engine plane that's already flying at lower altitudes and much more in the airspace, or helicopters, which of course fly at lower altitudes and have lots of different places where they can land. But it does seem like it's a question of time before there's some sort of incident, and hopefully it'll be a minor incident and it could cause a backlash.
So Enrico, just so people know how big an issue this is, tell me how many drones have been sold total. Roughly.
So it's millions have been sold total, even excluding RC aircraft, which, of course, are get swept up in the definition, right, of unmanned aerial vehicle. But over the Christmas holiday, the estimate's over 1 million drones. And, of course, there were a lot of drones sold before Christmas.
And last we chatted, there was 300,000 plus or so that had been registered with the FAA. Do you know where that number is now?
The last number I saw was 350,000 plus, and that was several weeks ago. So I think we're probably approaching the 400 or 500,000 mark, which is it's certainly not all of them, but it's 500,000 people who had to click I agree when they were shown the rules of the road, and which they may not have been aware of prior to registration.
All right. Well, we're running out of time in this segment. So if folks want to get plugged into you, find out more about all the drone laws, regulations, I know this is your area of expertise. Tell them how they can do that.
You could find us, Mike, at www.dronelaw.pro. That's .pro. And there's a lot of information on the website. And we basically will answer anyone's questions if you want to give us a call for free and help you understand the regulatory environment.
And you can find his columns and advice and whatnot on MI Tech News as well. I cover drones, and he's my drone man. So, yes. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so Matt.
All right. I thought you were going to say your name first.
Oh, sorry. This is Mike Brennan.
And this is Matt Rausch, and you're listening to the M Squared TechCast. Hang on just a second, and we'll be right back with some information about LTU summer camps, science summer camps for high school students.
Hey, it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch, and you're listening to the M Squared TechCast. And in our final segment for today, we have with us a guest from my employer, Lawrence Technological University. She is Lisa Kuyawa, Assistant Provost for Enrollment Management. And Lisa, I wanted you to talk today a little bit about LTU Summer Science Camps. Basically, if anyone's listening that has a kid or knows a kid who needs something cool to do over the summer, Lawrence Tech has some neat camp opportunities. So why don't you tell us about that a little bit, Lisa?
Yes, well, thank you so much, Matt. So let me say first, if I could go back a little bit, one of the reasons we started the camps was during the downturn in the economy when everyone was saying, no one will ever go into engineering again, and STEM, what are those jobs? They're a thing of the past. Well, now guess what? They're all a thing of the future.
Yeah.
So we started out with three camps, really, to promote the field of engineering. And then as it grew, we now have close to 30 camps. They are in all different fields of what we consider STEAM, right? Science, technology, engineering, architecture, art and design, and math. We have over 500 students that come to the camp each summer. Over half of them are out-of-state students.
Wow.
You have to be a sophomore, junior, and senior in high school to attend. And the really great thing is that what it does is it gives students the opportunity, especially to explore their passion. So, some students think, oh, I'm so great at math and science. I really want to go into engineering. And then they come to the camps and they go, wow, I think I'm more of a designer. So then we move them into that camp because that, fulfills their idea of that passion that they want to be able to develop. And 48% of those students will end up coming here as freshmen.
Ooh, wow, okay.
Sort of a little recruitment move then, huh?
Yes, and I thank you for saying that, Mike, because we really don't make a lot of money. It wasn't our intent to make money. We just didn't want to lose money. So we partner with different school districts. And now the our marketing department has just phenomenally expanded our reach with these programs, and we get people from all over. We have two people from Korea coming this summer already.
Wow!
I have over close to 300 applications already here for students who want to come. And once again, for parents, it gives them a great value. We haven't raised the prices in 2 years, so
let's talk about the price just so people know what ballpark we're in.
Okay, thank you. So we have two sets of prices. The camps are 1 week in length, and you can be and usually they're 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. or 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. They range anywhere from $600 for a commuter camp, meaning you come to that morning of the camp, you go to the camp, and then you leave at the end of that day, and then you return the next morning. Versus an $800 camp, which is a residential camp, where you come in the Sunday prior to the Monday camp beginning. We have 5 chaperones, all of our own students. They get the students acclimated. They have dinner with them. They show them around campus, basically tell them, here's where you can go, here's where you can't go. And then they get them up the next morning. They take them to their camps. They have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with them. And then we do a variety of activities in the evening. So one night we will take them to a Tigers game. Another night they will do a bowling program. The next night they will do a tour of the city of Detroit in terms of the architecture and the art of what's there. Sometimes we take one night, they just want to hang on campus and be like real college students are. And then one night we take and we kind of give them a tour of the campus from an admissions perspective, give them, show them our video, and talk to them about what it would mean to become a Blue Devil at LTU.
Sounds like the real package would be to do the extra $200 and be on campus and get the whole college experience, right?
It would, because it's so funny you say that, Mike, because believe it or not, students sometimes, they've never been away from home, and so they don't have that experience. And so it's a great experience for them to do that. They make long-lasting friends. And then what I love to see is when they come in the fall as freshmen, they're rooming together, so that's kind of neat too. The other thing I want parents to know, for all the parents listening, is that on the website, we do have ways they can earn discounts. If they come to certain programs, we'll give them $50 off. If they attend 2 camps, we'll give them $100 off. And then, I always tell parents, if there's a way we need to work with you, we will work with you, because it's more important for us to have them here to see the value of an LTU program and degree versus not having them here.
So what are the camps that are offered? What areas are covered?
Okay, good question. So we have art, architecture, and design. We have a sketching. We have a basic design, a web design, biomedical engineering. Building Big, which is all about civil engineering, automotive engineering. We have a forensic science camp, which is huge and popular. And what they basically do is dissect animals to show almost like a CSI format. Only
could,
with animals.
It could be CIA, but we're not sure. You know?
Exactly. And we also have architectural engineering. We have transportation design, which is a huge one.
Wow.
So they work in the studios and the labs. Either it's all hands-on, so no one's sitting there and lecturing to you. For example, our biomedical engineering, they take them to Beaumont and Providence, and they do activities there as well as here in our own lab.
No dissecting there, though, right?
So. No.
Well, one of the things I noticed on the one of the reasons you're here is I noticed on the poster promoting these things that they actually do a little bit of junior level genetic engineering at one of these camps, at the biotech camp, right?
Yes. So thank you for saying that. That is why we don't allow freshmen. Not because they're not wonderful people, but because the faculty have a very specific. You're not just going to come to play. You know, mm-hmm. the money your parents are spending, if they send you, you're learning a whole lot about the field, and that was the whole point. And sometimes, for example, the biomedical engineering camp has probably 7 full-time faculty that come at different points during the week to teach you very specific things about those genetics. So. You're really learning from, you know, people who have the expertise in this and that are trying to make it fun and give you the understanding of, hey, this is what you would do if you decided to pursue this field.
Do you typically have more applications than you have places, so it's more competitive then?
So you think I'd pay you to say that. This past year...
That $100, I'll be waiting for it, by the way.
Me too. This past year... The summer of 2015, we actually had to close the camps May 1st because our overall kind of philosophy here at the university is the leadership to theory and practice, and so the theory and practice within those camps are heavily exercised. So the idea that they learn the theory, but then they can have practical experience where they're actually doing hands-on things. So the faculty like to keep it 20 to 25 people. And so last year I started to go over and some, and then I had to stop. And so this year they told me flat out, no, we got, because they want to make it worthwhile for the student. They don't want the student not to be involved and active in what's going on within the lab or the studio, whatever they're doing. So I've said to parents who've all given me their things or who will give me their things that we will be closing it in May as well.
Is it on a first-come, first-served basis, or is there, you know, you get 1,000 applications and you choose the best, or how do you do that?
So it's first-come, first-served. I receive applications every single day. I've had actually since August of this year, starting of the fall.
Wow.
And I respond right back to the parent. They have to have all the forms in, plus the payment, and we correspond with them. Now, the Forensic Science Camp is the only camp that you actually have to be admitted to because they actually want to see how many years of physics and chemistry you have had. So that's just a different set of requirements. However, our Department for Natural Sciences, I work with them on corresponding with the parents, and so we pretty much go really quickly. They don't waste time at whether to admit or not. That camp is, they really do want them to have some knowledge of physics. And normally all the students, that's the other thing that some parents will say to me, well, is this just, you know, kids that just want to get away from home? It's like, no, they really are actually working. So we get the best of the best students.
That's very cool. Yeah, I noticed the forensic one is called Forensic Summer Science Institute, not camp. So it's
right.
a little bit more academic rigor there, I would think. Not exactly. That they're all not, but that one is even more so. Yeah.
Yep. And we are also looking at, because I've had many questions from parents about possibly putting credit to them.
Mm.
So the faculty said, well, you know, they're going to kind of experiment and see how they might do that, you know, by just kind of looking at all the modules they put together for the camps. And if possible, then possibly they would do that. But so we're just kind of, we're at the exploring stages of that.
Now, you're having some where people can come in and learn more about it, sessions coming up. I know there's a word that I'm suddenly, it's escaping
no,
me.
No, we just had a phenomenal open house on Saturday. We had over 1,000 people here. It was phenomenal. It was a great experience. But we do have what's called Blue and White Days. and it's every other Friday, and it's a nice way for parents and their students. It's from 10 until 1. It's a brief opportunity with lunch and with meeting our faculty for them to get an idea of our programs. They start out by showing the video, having a little admissions presentation. Our faculty come in the room and introduce themselves. Then they tell them, okay, we'll see you at lunch. Then they take them on a tour of the campus and the different labs and studios that we have to show that theory and practice. And then the students have a panel. Well, the parents can come too, but we have a student panel so they can ask our own students questions to get the real skinny on, you know, what's going on. And then they have lunch with our faculty and our students. And then they sometimes after that, usually that's about 12:30, quarter to one, and then they might branch out to leave or do some other things with specific faculty. But it is every other Friday, and it's a great brief way to really learn about LTU. And anyone who wants to go, if they went to ltu.edu, click on admissions and special events, and you'll see where you could sign up right online.
And I just happened to see the Blue and White Days here on the website. It's February 26th. That is this very Friday. March 25th, April 1st, and April 29th.
Yeah.
So,
man, Matt, you're good.
It's like he does this for a living or something. You
know, right?
But I mean, if you wait till April, I'm going to give you a little, this will help you out, right? Act now to avoid future disappointment, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, if you wait till April, there might not be any slots.
But
right?
Wait, there's more. Yes. Well, in this case, no, there's not. Once the slots are full, they're full.
No, yeah, it's true because this is, Mike, what you said is so funny because I probably had 30 calls this year in the fall from middle school parents who would love us to do middle school camps.
Mm.
Now, we're considering it, but our faculty put so much into these camps. I mean, they're not just, reading and lecturing to the students. There's actual projects and, you know, experiments and things that they're doing using design software and things like that. So people do, you're right, they want an experience and they try to get it sooner than later. So if they do wait till April, I have to say, now I can't guarantee anything.
Ooh. Okay. Lisa, if people want more information on these camps, real quick, what's the website?
It's ltu.edu and put summer camps in the search box, and that's the easiest way to find us. But anybody can email me at lkujawa@ltu.edu, and I'm happy to talk with them about the summer camps.
Okay. Thanks very much, Lisa Kuyawa, Assistant Provost for Enrollment Management at Lawrence Technological University. And that wraps up another fun-filled edition of the M Squared
TechCast. It goes by so quickly, doesn't it?
I know. I always wonder, what are we going to talk about for a whole hour? And then I feel like we could do another. So,
oh, easily, yeah.
Okay,
we'll have to talk to Bob and Dave about that.
Maybe.
Right?
So maybe we could do that.
Get 2 hours worth. But anyway, Jessica's given us that look, so we got to wrap things up because we don't want to get crosswise with Jessica.
No, she's our great engineer.
Yes.
So, yeah, okay.
So this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you've been listening to M Squared TechCast, and we hope you join us again next week.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.
This is a previously recorded episode.